This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And yesterday, Monday, was our first opportunity on this program to react to the George Zimmerman verdict and the Trayvon Martin case. And we spoke with some African-American parents and some legal experts about how this directly affects their lives. And today, we extend that discussion to another group of people whose role in our communities may now be questioned by the verdict in the Zimmerman case. People who ostensibly do what George Zimmerman said he was doing in Sanford, Florida in 2012, watching his neighborhood. But folks, there are neighborhood watchers all around America. In 1972, a formal U.S. Neighborhood Watch program was established by the National Sheriff's Association. This is a long and venerable tradition that runs parallel to America's complicated history with suspicion of strangers, worries about crime, access to guns. Self-policed neighborhood watches go back to the American Revolution. They resurfaced during Prohibition, during the Cold War, as a projection of our fear of communism. And it's a response to the crime waves of the 60s and 70s in urban America. This tradition is being examined again. Here's what people in our audience are saying about this citizen watch idea following the Zimmerman verdict. In Portland, Oregon, one listener said, "I have never lived in a place where the police were not sufficient protection for my neighborhood, nor do I understand gated communities that hire their own armed guards." From North Augusta, South Carolina, a listener said, I think they're a good idea, but I'll also say that the head of my local watch," again from this listener, "is one of the nuttiest wing nuts I've ever met." From Lubbock, Texas, a listener says, "I think they are a symptom of a paranoid society." From Clarkston, Michigan, "I believe that when properly utilized, neighborhood watch groups can be excellent deterrents," a sampling of people from our audience. Our next guests are possibly facing such broad brush characterization by a nation who, before the death of Trayvon Martin and the George Zimmerman verdict, didn't have much of a sense of the 20,000 local neighborhood watch programs operating across the United States. Peter Nichols is the founder and coordinator of the Melrose Action Neighborhood Watch in Los Angeles, California. Welcome, Peter.
Hey, hello.
Barry Mullen has established crime watches on over 70 blocks in his neighborhood in Dorchester, Massachusetts. Barry, welcome to the show.
Hi.
And Larkin Eggleston is a neighborhood watch chairman for the Plaza Midwood Neighborhood Association in Charlotte, North Carolina. Larkin, welcome to you.
Thank you.
So to all three of you, the blunt question here is, suddenly, is what you do be the George Zimmerman of your neighborhood? Is that how people are going to look at you now, Peter Nichols?
No, not at all. You know, here in Los Angeles, the LAPD has a very long-standing community relations program, and it's a partnership. So I don't see any association, and I don't feel there's any sense of antagonistic feeling from the community out there at large at all.
Larkin Eggleston, does the George Zimmerman verdict and the case of Trayvon Martin define you in any sense?
No, I think it's all about kind of the attitude you have and the situation you create. Our neighborhood watch is certainly not encouraging anybody to drive around, get out of their vehicle, and confront someone they think isn't supposed to be in the neighborhood or might be committing a crime. Ours is more about creating a sense of awareness so that people are watching out for their neighbors, looking for things that seem out of place, and then calling the police to let them deal with those situations.
And Barry Mullen, are you suddenly Barry Zimmerman up there in Dorchester?
No, I agree with the other two gentlemen have said. Basically, we're just working to get people to know each other and to look out for each other, call the police, build those relationships.
What is the tradition, and I'll begin with you, Barry, of Neighborhood Watch? What is the motivation for starting these sorts of groups? What are the rules? How do you oversee the behavior of individuals?
I think here in Dorchester, the reason we started it up is because the neighborhood had a lot of disconnect. People weren't talking to each other. You know, with forced busing years ago, kids are being bused all over the neighborhood, all over the city, and parents didn't get a chance to talk to each other. So we're just trying to introduce people to who live on their streets and just get to know each other and to watch out for each other. That's basically where we are. And work directly with the police. You know, we call 911. You know, I would never get out of a car and confront somebody. It doesn't make sense. It's not my job.
And what's the history, Larkin Eggleston, of the Plaza Midwood Neighborhood Association and the watch chairmanship that you're currently in right now?
Yeah, much the same. I mean, ours is more about encouraging people to know who lives in their neighborhood, to be aware of what cars are usually parked in what driveways and things like that. So it's, again, it's really more about connecting the neighborhood, giving people an excuse to talk to each other and know each other, because the closer you are and the more you know with your neighbors, the more you're going to be able to spot something that's unusual or out of place.
Peter Nichols, since the verdict, you've been directly affected in that some neighborhoods have been concerned about protests and violence, and we even saw a little of that over the last 24 hours. What's going on?
Well, I think there's, you know, a little sense of unease after definitely last night. You know, there was a peaceful demonstration in an area called Leimert Park, and probably about 100 people out of maybe nearly a couple of thousand just kind of lost their minds a bit. So, you know, we're all on notice. You know, the LAPD, I'm told there's another protest today at 4 o'clock. And so they're kind of letting word get out there that they're going to really have a no-tolerance policy for any more crazy behavior.
All right. Well, that's a good update there. Peter, Barry, and Larkin, let me ask all three of you, do you or any of the people in your neighborhood watch groups carry firearms? Larkin?
We're actually looking at putting in place some more specific policies in terms of what we encourage people to do or discourage people to do. I guess if they're a legal concealed carry weapons holder, then, you know, it's legal for them to carry. We certainly wouldn't want to encourage people again to try and deal with these situations themselves. Our course of action is always going to be to recommend people see something and call police to let them deal with it, not try to do it themselves.
Barry Mullen, how about you? What's the policy there?
No guns, whistles, and cell phones. That's what we deal directly with the police.
And Peter Nichols, how about firearms there in Los Angeles?
Our only firearm is your finger dialing 911.
All right. So this is a tough question for all three of you, because we spoke with a number of African-American parents yesterday on the program, and pundits and people who've been reacting to this. You've probably seen some of these kinds of remarks on media in the last 48 hours or so. But a jury in Florida basically said it is completely reasonable down there in the state of Florida that if you see a young man in a hoodie who's African-American, it's perfectly reasonable to think that they might be a threat. How do you respond to that, and does that change anything that you do in your neighborhood watch responsibilities? Larkin?
I mean, I think that's ridiculous. I would like to think that's not what the jury's mindset was, but certainly that's not something. I mean, the neighborhood that we live in here has not only a blend of white, black families, but also Hispanic and Asian, probably one of the most diverse neighborhoods in Charlotte. So the hope would be that if you moved into this neighborhood, you weren't intolerant. If you were, you picked a really bad neighborhood to move into. But the thought that seeing someone of a different skin color in this neighborhood would mean something was wrong would be pretty far off base.
Barry?
I find that pretty insane as well. You know, Boston's like the League of Nations. We have everybody here, and you know, we just have to understand that people are different, cultures are different, people wear different clothes. I mean, it's just, to me, it's just an insane thing.
And Peter Nichols, how about you? It's reasonable to assume people in hoodies are threats. That's what the jury might have delivered as a message down there in Sanford, Florida.
That's totally crazy and out of sync. I concur with everybody else. We have a multicultural, very, very diverse neighborhood and members of our watch. I don't see any connection to that at all. This is a thing of suspicion or, you know, keeping an eye out for one another. It runs the gamut of every race, color, creed. It's a matter of a suspect, not of a certain persuasion. That doesn't come into our psyche here.
There a sense, though, for all of you that this whole case and the national debate that's been going on here has made it harder for you to do what you do, that this is a moment that is painful for you because it speaks against really the proud tradition that all three of you seem to be upholding? Larkin?
No, I mean, I think that it gives us probably all reason to step back and say, well, maybe we should have some more cut and dry policies and cut and dry procedures. But I think that it sounds like none of the three of us are involved in programs that would ever encourage a situation like what happened, where somebody confronts a person that they don't know and that they don't know to be doing anything wrong. So I think that the people in our neighborhoods probably know that what we're doing is nothing like what took place down in Florida. And so I don't think that it's going to draw any extra scrutiny, but I think it does give us a good opportunity to reevaluate the policies and procedures we have in place.
Barry?
I agree as well, and I think that we need more training. We have community service officers that go out to these crime watches and to talk about this stuff. We're in the process of putting together a neighborhood watch university where we can train people who are in these crime watches, and again, to do it more by calling 911 and not reacting the way Mr. Zimmerman did.
Peter Nichols, has it changed, made it harder for you to uphold the tradition that you've been involved with there in Melrose?
No, because, you know, we've had in place with the Los Angeles Police Department community policing for many years. So I talked to our commanders at our Wilshire division here, our senior lead officers for our area, 2, 3, 4, 5 times a day. I mean, this is a cooperative situation that we run. This is nothing rogue or anything. I don't know what the situation in Sanford is like, but I foresee there's more of these issues in departments that are smaller, that are less trained and less community driven. You know, this is very much a deal with community policing here. I would think for, you know, my colleagues here, it would be the same thing.
Gut feeling for the three of you before we go, and we don't want to disparage the people of Florida. Could this happen anywhere, or is this a Florida thing, this case, Peter?
I think this is a rogue thing. I think, you know, anything is possible anywhere with anyone.
Barry Mullen, a Florida thing, the Trayvon Martin Zimmerman case, or could it happen anywhere?
It could happen anywhere, but unfortunately, you know, I just don't see violence solving violent problems. To me, it just blows my mind. I just think it went way too far. I don't know. I'm just blown away with this whole thing.
Larkin Eggleston, final thought from you.
I mean, it could certainly happen anywhere. You can't ultimately control what any one individual is going to do. So there's probably somebody in every state who, you know, sees themselves as the arm of the law, despite the fact that they're not a sworn officer. And if you've got a person who is a bit overzealous, to say the least, in a neighborhood watch program, it's something you need to monitor or maybe prevent that person from being a part of it, because you certainly don't want to be the next state where something like this happens.
Well, Peter, Barry, and Larkin, thanks so much for a candid discussion this morning. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
My name is Rachel. I'm calling from Hawaii. People are downsizing their police departments and allowing for more personal community policing, which I think is extremely dangerous and will play out in a bad way in our future.
What's your reaction to our three neighborhood watchers there who were just speaking about how they do their job in the wake of the George Zimmerman verdict? The listener in Hackensack, New Jersey writes, a good idea when it helps the police, bad idea when neighbors take the law into their own hands. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and be a part of the conversation. You can find us at facebook.com/The Takeaway. Coming up, the head of the Zetas drug cartel arrested. That's coming up here on The Takeaway. So here's a big story. Miguel Angel Trevino Morales, one of the most wanted men in Mexico, was captured last night by Mexican Marines just south of the Texas border. Trevino is the leader of the Zetas, one of Mexico's most violent drug cartels, known by the nickname Z-40. Trevino is, anyway. He was wanted for murder, torture, and organized crime in Mexico and for drug and gun charges here in the U.S. Joining us from Mexico City is Randall Archibald, Mexico, Central America, and Caribbean Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. Randall, welcome.
Nice to be with you.
Give us a characterization of what your average citizen in Mexico City might think of the character of Miguel Angel Trevino Morales, Z-40.
They probably associate him with the Zetas. He's the head of the Zetas, which is considered among the most brutal, violent of the drug organizations operating here in Mexico. They are founded by former special forces from the military and had a very disciplined way of sending messages to their rivals by cutting off their heads and dismembering bodies and hanging victims from bridges. So they are responsible for a lot of the shocking sensational violence in Mexico.
Is this a peace in our time moment for Mexicans who have endured so much violence as the government and the cartels battle each other openly?
I think this arrest is very significant and differs from some of the others in that the Zetas have been considered to be a little bit on the wane. From the Mexican forces have arrested or killed several of their leaders, rival cartels, including the Sinaloa cartel headed by Chapo Guzman, the most wanted man in the world on drug crimes, have been attacking them. So the feeling is that this could be a turning point, a key turning point for the Zetas, in that he was captured alive, raising the prospect that they could get valuable intelligence from him on the other leaders of the organization and their internal operations.
Do you think, Randall Archibald of the New York Times, that this is a turning point politically for the Mexican president and the political authorities?
If you talk to many analysts who watch U.S.-Mexico relations, what they're saying is that this is quite significant for Enrique Peña Nieto, the president of Mexico, mainly because there was a perception that maybe he wouldn't take on the cartels as aggressively as his predecessor did. His aides have openly questioned the so-called kingpin strategy of taking out leaders, and which often leads to more violence because there's chaos and internal strife within these organizations. What's furthermore, the new government had put new restrictions and rules on intelligence sharing with the Americans, leading many to wonder if these guys are really serious about the drug fight. So he was under some pressure internationally and even at home to show that he was, going to keep up the fight. It's been said that when he did take down a big cartel leader, he wanted it done with primarily Mexican forces and Mexican intelligence. There are signs that the DEA may have helped in this case, but so far they're being very coy on the level of their involvement in this.
I mean, appearances can be deceiving, and not that Teddy Roosevelt is terribly popular south of the U.S. border, but it does seem to be a classic speak softly and carry a big stick in regards to a very serious security threat inside Mexico.
Well, I think what their analysis is that, you know, we've had 6 years of attacking the cartels, and we've had, you know, tens of thousands of people killed or gone missing. Maybe there's a better way to do this, and that has always been their outlook and their approach. But they're also very sensitive to the image of Mexico, and so I think people were wondering, would they be so image conscious and simply ignore the problem instead of truly taking it on? But last night's arrest at least shows that when they do have good intelligence on where these guys are or may be, that they do seem prepared to act on it and to try to bring people to justice.
So are the other cartels on notice because of this arrest, or did the government just do a favor for Morales' rivals?
That's a good question. I mean, there's always speculation that the government favors one cartel over another so that the cartel can do the dirty work of eliminating the other bad guys. I think time will tell. I mean, I honestly don't have an answer to that, but I do believe that this may mark a big change for the Zetas, and it may allow for more arrests or more operations against them if Z40, as he's known, 40, if he does provide valuable information on the inner workings of this notorious, brutal group.
Finally, what's the chance that U.S. investigators will get their hands on Morales Z40 anytime soon?
He has charges pending in the United States. He was one of the most wanted by the DEA. He has drug and gun charges pending in New York and Texas. They're so far not commenting on whether they will seek his extradition. I think it's a safe bet that the U.S. might ask to question him, and we'll see if the Mexicans allow that.
All right. Randall Archibald is the Mexico, Central America, and Caribbean Bureau Chief for our partner, the New York Times, reacting to the arrest of one of the most powerful and violent cartel leaders in Mexico last night. Randall, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You may have missed this story last week.
Now, in most people's eyes, Albert DeSalvo has been known as the Boston Strangler, but without direct evidence linking him, questions and legitimate questions have lingered about that perpetrator.
A break in the Boston Strangler case, a brutal murder mystery, the killing of 11, possibly even 13 women in Boston that has never been definitively linked to the longtime suspect and confessed killer, Albert DeSalvo, until a DNA match last week, announced there by Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley. But you're much more likely to know the Hollywood version of the Boston Strangler case.
We've got no fingerprints, no witnesses, nothing.
They don't think it's one man.
This is the Boston Strangler in the flesh.
This is the biggest case we've ever had.
It's not going away because the killing isn't just going to stop.
That's actually a remake of The Boston Strangler. The first movie was a famous, controversial film starring Tony Curtis as DeSalvo back in 1968. The Strangler case shows how popular understanding of a crime can actually complicate the justice system's search for the truth. And here to talk about that is Philip Martin, investigative reporter for our partner WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Philip.
John, thanks a lot.
Does DNA and this DNA breakthrough that we've been talking about here, does it change things? Does it really refute the popular culture sense of eternal mystery regarding the Boston Strangler case?
Well, you think about a case like this, and you think about this whole notion of a popular imagination. And this case, basically, because it was unsolved, you could basically infer anything from the Boston Strangler case, the whole notion of imagining who the suspect or suspects are. And that's what we've seen for years, including a recent Boston Strangler movie that came out in 2008. That interpretation inferred that there was more than one strangler. With the DNA match by the authorities here in Massachusetts, a DNA sample that was taken surreptitiously from a nephew of Albert DeSalvo, the confessed Boston Strangler, they were able to connect Albert DeSalvo definitively to his last victim. This is, Mary Sullivan. This DNA match, called a familial match, fit exactly. It was taken from a blanket that was from the scene of the crime in 1964, January 4th, 1964, when this young woman was assaulted. The blanket was saved by a detective. That blanket was recovered. But in order to ascertain whether or not there was a DNA match to what was found on the scene, they had to obtain another sample. Authorities got that sample surreptitiously, followed a nephew of Albert DeSalvo. When he dropped a cup, they grabbed the cup, matched the DNA on the cup to Albert DeSalvo, and zam, there you have it, of a confirmation of Albert DeSalvo as the killer of Mary Sullivan.
I can see Hollywood taking that set of circumstances and turning that into a movie right there. But I guess the irony here is Albert DeSalvo served much of his life in prison, convicted of other crimes. It's kind of ironic and a little sad that the families of the victims had to endure this sense of doubt so long by Hollywood and popular culture.
Well, that doubt is not over. You're right. Albert DeSalvo died in prison on unrelated charges, robbery and sexual assault, but never, ever convicted of killing these 11, possibly 13 women. And the conclusion of this case, I'm afraid, is not conclusive at all. What this DNA has determined, there's a link, of course, between Albert DeSalvo and Mary Sullivan definitively, but there are other women. Their cases have not been solved.
Once again, we learn DNA is not definitive and cannot solve the mysteries of doubt sown in the human heart. Philip Martin, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Philip Martin, investigative reporter for our partner WGBH, Boston Public Radio. We want to report now on a standoff between the courts and California's state prison system, one of the country's largest, and one that has been judged to be overcrowded and underfunded, with prisoners facing inhumane and unsanitary conditions such as lack of access to clean water. This has been going on for years. Federal judges have twice threatened to hold Governor Jerry Brown in contempt of court if he does not comply with an order to release 10,000 inmates and transfer 2,600 others who could be exposed to a deadly disease in the state's overcrowded prisons. A hunger strike by prisoners protesting conditions is entering its second week. With us from San Francisco to help us understand what's going on is Michael Bean. He's one of the lawyers who's represented inmates in this very, very complicated case. Michael, welcome.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this is a collision, if we can say it, of the criminal justice system, of the prison system, and really a dysfunctional or allegedly dysfunctional mental health system in the state of California. How do you see it?
Well, I think there has been a tremendously dysfunctional prison system that has been unable to deliver a minimally adequate constitutional level of health care to the prisoners incarcerated in that system. The result has been, tremendous suffering, unnecessary pain and death. This has been established again and again in several different lawsuits in California that are proceeding. Despite these findings by these courts that have already been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, our governor, Jerry Brown, has refused to comply with the court orders to reduce the population so that health care can finally be delivered in a minimally adequate, humane way.
What is the mental health care piece of all of this, and what is the sort of fiscal overcrowding sense of all this here?
Well, the mental health care is a case that we brought initially, believe it or not, in 1990. We have got a judgment in 1995 that on behalf of a class of all prisoners with serious mental illness, and that California was violating their constitutional rights. It was not providing minimally adequate mental health care, wasn't screening for people, wasn't providing medications, and in fact was also using segregation and punishment to address the mentally ill rather than treatment. Despite many years of attempting to remedy the problems, in 2006, overcrowding in the prison system was so extreme that we in the mental health case and our co-counsel in the medical case brought a motion to reduce the prison populations to address overcrowding, saying that overcrowding was overwhelming all other problems in the prisons and made finishing these cases impossible. Governor Schwarzenegger had declared an overcrowding emergency in the same year. He had said that overcrowding was also a problem that was standing in the way of the prison system doing anything. And that made it more possible. He himself was agreeing that overcrowding was a problem. We went to a trial, and that's the case that was affirmed by the U.S. Supreme Court just 2 years ago in the spring of 2011.
And yet we're still in a situation where there are inmates in the prison, even though there are orders to have them released. Many of these cases are going back to court. I can understand the political sensitivity of a governor not wanting to release inmates into the community, and also a bankrupt state that is not in a position to build a lot of new prisons very, very quickly. We reached out to the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation. They didn't have any comment on this case. They said mental health care is not their responsibility. That belongs to the California Department of State hospitals. We've got a hunger strike going on by inmates trying to change this situation, change the standoff. How do you see the state's reluctance to act here?
Well, it's a little bit. I think what needs to be clarified, John, is there's really no. This is really a very similar, as one of the judges has said, to the Southern governors trying just to stand up to the federal courts, just on principle. Let me just clarify. There is no fiscal obstacle to doing the population reduction. Getting people, diverting people up front from prison saves money. California has terrible sentencing laws. Reforming those laws would save money. We demonstrated at trial that California would save money, improve public safety, and reduce crowding if they adopted measures that many other states, including New York, where you are, have already adopted. New York has successfully reduced its prison population and reduced crime at the same time. And what we demonstrated with experts from around the country is that California, it has a dramatically high rate of incarceration, that rate could be reduced and the prison crowding could be reduced without any effect on crime. And in fact, it's already come down. The prison population has already been reduced substantially since the court order. But Governor Brown has just, you know, dug in his heels on this last sense, last bit.
Although despite the civil rights comparison to the Southern governors that you spoke about earlier, the National Guard is not likely to be called out here to release prisoners from prison. And regardless of the outcome of this hunger strike, what do you think is going to change things?
Well, Jerry Brown has said that more recently that he will abide by the U.S. Supreme Court decision this year. He has not been abiding by the U.S. Supreme Court decision of the 2011. He has refused to comply. But he is now, in fact, it's pending right now before Justice Kennedy, a motion to stay the orders of the lower courts pending a new appeal by the California to the Supreme Court. Our briefs are due in opposition to that before Justice Kennedy at the end of this week, and presumably within the next weeks or months, not till the end of next year, but I think within the next month or so, we will hear from the Supreme Court, yay or nay, on whether there will be a stay.
And the standoff will continue until that time, at the very least. Michael Bean, thanks so much.
Sure. Thank you, John.
Michael Bean represents inmates in the California prison system, which is facing court orders to reduce overcrowding. Let's return now to the big story of the week. And I guess you might be forgiven in America for thinking that the whole Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman case is just another ride on the American sunshine theme park state of Florida. You know, the state with its own history of racial tensions, with its own approach to gun laws, a state shaped like a gun. Okay, maybe Oklahoma has a gun barrel panhandle. But this case, is it just another hanging chad in the Casey Anthony curiosity of American culture called the state of Florida? Do we shake our heads, all of us, north of Tallahassee and west of Miami, and say, never happened here? Well, our next guest says that's wrong. Big time, dead wrong. Author, journalist, he's reported from around the world, T.D. Allman, has written many books. Perhaps his most passionate and most recent is Finding Florida. Allman says right there in Florida is all of American history, the good and the bad.
What's missing in our whole understanding of ourselves and of Florida is the tragic sense of history. You know, what we have to do when we look at Florida is see the darkness within ourselves.
So Florida is much more generalizably a microcosm of America.
Absolutely. Florida has two aspects which are complementary and only seemingly opposite. It is both aberrant and paradigmatical. By that I mean, of course, it's a nutty place. It's geographically bizarre. It is new. It's very big. For historic reasons, it does not have strong institutional traditions or intellectual traditions. At the same time, I really want to say there are very few white males of my age or females who, when they see a young black male on the street, do not somehow feel slightly alarmed. Now, what happens in a state when, say, oh, that's perfectly fine to feel that way? Furthermore, you've got the right to get out of the car, go after this black male who never came near you, and when something happens, you can shoot him dead. This is what Florida says. Now, similarly, the Stand Your Ground law, it bespeaks so many things, John. One of them is how words don't mean anything anymore. When they were putting this through the legislature, it's like these people, we all know who we mean by people. They're the people Zimmerman talked about in that recording.
African Americans.
They come into your house. Well, you don't stand your ground when you get out of a car and go after somebody. This law is the continuation of the black codes. And the Republican-controlled legislature of Tallahassee a few years ago actually apologized for Florida racism. It says the most virulent institutionalized form of racism in the United States, and they apologized for it. They then went on and passed the Stand Your Ground law, which basically the key thing in the past of all racist legislation is the motivating fear of the uppity slave, the runaway slave. I can't use the N-word, but we all know that's what people are thinking when they do these things. And the one thing the black male must never be allowed to do is fight back. And when he does, you can shoot him.
You suggest here, though, that we can't escape history, that Florida is on some sort of cutting edge of America's sense of denial and America's sense of an inability to deal with race. But isn't there a sense that we can escape history? We can get beyond it.
Yes.
We can move beyond these sorts of things?
Yes, exactly what happens is immigration saves us. The state of Florida only had slavery for 15 years, and yet it marked Florida ever after. But what's coming in is immigration. The increasing diversity of America is what saves us and which opens up new possibilities.
Why hasn't that saved Florida, maybe to the extent that this wouldn't have happened?
Yeah, I'll tell you, part of it is sometimes the worst reactionaries and the worst racists are the Yankees who come down. After Reconstruction, and they undid the work of civil rights in starting in 1876, the three worst governors, one was born in New Hampshire, the other was born in Florida, and the third was born in Massachusetts. And they come down, they adopt racism. They don't call it racism. Of course, we're not allowed to do that anymore. But I want to tell your audience and tell anybody else who'll listen, this is what we're dealing with. And the problem with Florida is that what's the bad and the good of, let's take the good in immigration. I wrote another book about Florida called Miami City of the Future. Everybody said, oh, Miami's horrible, all these strange people there, it's not a part of America anymore. I said, that is America. That's our future. And here we have the same thing. I mean, we are putting guns into the hands of babies. We are putting guns into the hands of vigilantes like Zimmerman. I want to mention one other thing I noticed when I was writing the book, and it's beginning to get a little attention. Just after Zimmerman, around the time that Zimmerman killed Trayvon Martin unarmed, a woman in Jacksonville shot off a gun because her abusive partner was running after her. Apparently the bullet went into a wall. She was sentenced to 20 years in prison.
No, a lot of people have noted that.
What's in common here? The guy who doesn't get punished has killed a black. The woman who gets sent to 20 years in prison for wounding a wall is black. Now, we will never transcend this until we face up to it. Yet America is too big and sloppy to ever go in any one direction. I mean, I could have predicted 10 years or 20 years ago that Trayvon Martin, somebody would shoot a black kid and the law of Florida would give him a pat on the back and say, oh, go home. I really couldn't have predicted that Florida would vote for a black man for president twice in a row.
So there are interesting contradictions even amidst this tragedy and sadness.
Yeah, but what we have to face up to, and we won't, our institution. One of the really great themes here is how our whole electoral, administrative, and judicial system is increasingly detached from what it needs to do to help us lead civilized. I want to say one more thing. Florida today has more of its people disfranchised via various pretexts, 20% of the black population and 10% of the white population, the poor white population, of course. And none of this is ever going to be fixed until we get past this idea that big government in Washington is the problem. Believe me, you look at history, we need a national government to protect our human rights and our constitutional rights. Trayvon Martin was an American, and he should not have been subjected to that.
T.D. Allman, author most recently of the book Finding Florida, reacting to the Trayvon Martin, George Zimmerman verdict. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
This is Kervasio from Miami, Florida. I think these neighborhood watches should always be done very cautiously. It happened to me that I was walking in my own neighborhood and somebody started following me. It ended up being some guy that wanted to police our neighborhood. He didn't know me, and he almost got in a fight with me. And this was just 2 months after Trayvon's death.
Thanks to our listener, Hervacho, from Miami, Florida. Voices from Florida weighing in, voices from around the country weighing in reaction to the Zimmerman case. Words of caution here from a listener from Charlotte, North Carolina, on the question of should there be neighborhood watch programs. Conceptually, it makes a lot of sense, but it also is a breeding ground for vigilantism, encourages untrained people to impede in the system of justice. That's one view. Here's another.
John Miller from Salem, Massachusetts. I'm just wondering why nobody's looking at the fact of Trayvon attacking the person. Why not take the step towards de-escalating and taking that prop so that it does accelerate the situation?
How to prevent the Trayvon Martin incident from happening in the future. We always want to hear from you. Give us your story. Give us a call, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway. You can listen back to anything on our program at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.